listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 17th installment in our series with Professor Luciana Bone, taking a look at the history and the political economy of the world's first socialist state, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, or USSR, more commonly known as the Soviet Union. Luciana, it's a pleasure to have you back. I'm really enjoying this series of discussions, as our listeners are. I'm getting a lot of positive feedback. And I guess we had promised we would pick up. We were discussing the Spanish Civil War. Towards the end of our conversation, we got to a point where you had listed the grouping of various tendencies on the right that's, you know, successfully unified to seize power. And I had made an observation that this stands in contrast to what the left usually does, that for some reason the right is able to act in a unitary way and settle their scores with the left first and then fight with each other, whereas the left fights with itself first and then never gets to the second phase.
Sadly, yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's good to be back with you talking. I enjoy it too. And I'm so pleased that you're getting positive responses.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, well, okay. The left...
I guess what we're talking about is that it seems that the right has no compunction about who it allies with, as long as it understands, within a strategic context, that tactical alliances help to win the day, and that you can settle the differences with your allies, quote unquote, after you defeat your enemies. Whereas the left almost seems that I can't engage with you unless you pass an ideological test in the first place, which means I'm going to be fighting this battle alone if I decide I'm worthy.
Because I have my own theory.
Yes, yeah.
Of how to bring socialism about.
Exactly.
But of course, the Comintern, the 1935 Comintern, International Communist Parties, which delegates of, which met in Moscow in 1935, proposed such a unity.
Right.
Within the United Front, which would gather all classes in the fight of against fascism.
Right.
So the proposal under the guidance of the Soviet Union of the Comintern was unity.
Yeah, I mean, this is the big sin, too, that the, you know, various leftists point to Stalin and the party at that time as, you know,
yeah.
they're not up to the ideological snuff because they're willing to ally themselves with bourgeois forces, with socialists with contrary tendencies, et cetera, et cetera. The big sin, in other words, is that they're willing to unify to win.
Yeah, the national, what did I say?
Oh,
the
United Front.
Front.
Yeah,
not the National Front.
The United Front.
Here, that's National Front is
right,
Franco forces.
Right.
Yeah, the main communist, you know, the only communist state in the world, one-sixth of the world, which was the Soviet Union, gather the Comintern parties, the Comintern, I'm repeating what I just said.
Yes.
There was a decision made that fascism must be fought along a united front.
Right.
Okay?
That's
now,
right.
What was the left, what left opposed this?
Mm.
Okay, so that's...
Yeah. That's worth having that conversation.
Is it a left even?
Right. No pun intended.
Okay, we're having a little joke here. But
You know, it's interesting because just to digress for a moment, and I think this is the part that's relevant to this particular moment that we're living in now. The theory behind it was that if the fascists gain power, there will be nothing left to in the aftermath to fight over. That, you know, human civilization may well end up being destroyed, and so the revolution, the development of human society towards communism will be thwarted because humanity may well end. And now, of course, that is even more possible. We have nuclear weapons. They're deployed to the borders of Russia and China. We have maniacs that are discussing how to use them. And an open fight in the U.S. government now over who's going to get to push the button. We've never had that before. That's actually going on now.
Yes. And of course, this is what the argument I would make is that unless the left, whatever it is or claims to be, unites against war, which is a real threat.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, we are in the same condition we were in the 1930s, and that is that we have to oppose the version of fascism that we have today, which is this international ambition to on the West. On the part of the West to own the world. I mean, these are the heirs of fascism, these ideas.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So, even the ecologists should be able to acknowledge that war has devastated, that in the battlefields of the First World War, some areas are still off limits because of the poisons, and that's 100 years.
Yep.
And all we have to think about is Vietnam.
Yeah, for sure.
And the poisons there, and everywhere else where we drop poisons. So
and not only that. And by the way, we just saw on the news today in Cambodia some other ecological legacy from that war is that there's a lot of places you can't walk in Cambodia without blowing up.
Yeah,
I would consider that environmental pollution also.
Yes, and in Vietnam the same thing.
Yes.
Some good good American soldiers who had fought in Vietnam are there, what do you call it, defusing the bombs.
Right, that's right. Yep, because they're all over the place. And of course, you have that happen all over the Middle East as well. They've been dropping mines and, you know, and whatever else everywhere. And those open pits that they burn. And the other thing is that apparently in the normal operation of human society and global economy, the largest single source of pollution of all kinds is the U.S. military. So, you know, that's without fighting a war.
Yeah, so that's right. Okay, focusing on what happened in Spain between the left. So, you know. Now, I begin with this statement. There was a civil war in Spain, but we have to remember that there were Moscow trials, charges of treason against the Trotskyist plotters.
Right.
And this is highly, okay. Oh, I have to just focus. I would like to propose the idea that that within the Spanish Civil War, that from the Spanish Civil War, with the experience contemporaneous of the Spanish Civil War, it was the Moscow trials acknowledge a civil war within the Soviet Union.
Right.
Okay. Now, because out of the Spanish Civil War came a mythology that the Stalinist Soviet Union had crushed the social revolution of the anarchists and Trotskyists to please Britain and France, and that the Soviet Union had failed to support the nationalist mobilization in Spanish Morocco, which, in the eyes of these mythologists, might have weakened Franco's army. So, okay, let me continue. But the Soviet Union learned valuable lessons from the Spanish Civil War, too. That these charges came from a fifth column, what they call a fifth column.
Right.
And, of course, these forces were the anarchists and the Trotskyists. And he learned, too, that the rise of a similar fifth column in Spain had to be the rise of a similar fifth column in Russia or in the Soviet Union had to be blocked in the Soviet Union itself if the coming assault by Hitler had to be repelled. So this is how, and this is my theory, okay? I think it's hinted, perhaps, but I have never seen it spelled out. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's just that my research has not gone that far. It's just beginning. So what am I saying here? That in the Spanish Civil War, which was occurring at the same time as the Moscow trials of 36 and 37, against the treason of part of the military and the left opposition, are connected. That there are. Can you elucidate on what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or kind of. You're so concise, because I'm just developing this, so I'm very, you know, hesitant.
Well, I mean, and it's very complex too, and you're pointing to the complexity of it by tying these two things together. You know, you have on the one hand Stalin and those in the party who were the dominant, dominant members among the inner circle. In other words, who's the people that were making the actual policy that was being implemented. And for all of the massive propaganda that was being employed against it, you know, this was a, to step out of it for a second, this was an existential threat to global capitalism. The idea that a backwards you know, like 10 minutes ago, feudal society could, within a generation, become a modern state based upon a workers' order, a socialist order that did not involve capital. This idea was not only heresy, but it was the kind of heresy that we saw with the Reformation with Martin Luther. It was an existential threat to the existing order. And so everything was being done to see that this was not actualized. And where they couldn't stop it from being actualized, everything was being done. New technologies, in fact, were being invented in order to misrepresent it to humanity so that its obvious contagious properties could be contained. In other words, if workers in a backwards, feudal, rural country like Russia was at the devastated at the end of 1917, 1918, if they could turn around and build a modern state as workers and without a bourgeoisie driving it, without capital exploiting them, then this is something that made every other worker in the world a candidate for the thought, gee, we don't need these guys either. And so all the stops were pulled out. And among those things, you had, first you had the war that was, you know, going on from the moment the Bolsheviks took power with, from the West, the U.S., the U.K., the French, the Germans. Everybody had troops in Russia, around Russia. They had saboteurs blowing up things. People would, you know, organize, build a factory out of dust practically. And then suddenly, oops, it blew up. You know, when they'd find out that, the, you know, some guy smuggled something in from Germany or whatever. So there was a massive assault against this effort. The entire construction of the Soviet state occurred under a condition of siege. I'm only touching the, you know, barest points on that particular thing. And so inside the government as well, there were plenty of people who were either agents of, you know, these parties outside, or had their own ideas about, well, with such concentration of state and economic power in a few hands, I could end up being the next czar. And they were competing on that basis as well. So in that climate, you had, you know, the inner party circle steering, you know, both the government and the economy to a position that ended up allowing them to defeat Hitler. And in less than 40 years after the revolution, in the conditions I described before, go into outer space ahead of the whole of the rest of humanity. Those people were under attack from people inside the party and inside the Soviet Union, behind mainly Trotsky, who was attacking it ostensibly from the left. Now you have a leftist state that is being successfully constructed, and you have someone who's saying, no, you can't do that. That is supposed to be a critique from the left. But in fact, it was a critique from the right, because the attack was from the right, and this was one of the modes of attack.
Yes, I'm deviating from this exciting summary from you. I want to add that the threat to the capitalist world was the success, the economic success of the Soviet Union.
Yep.
The political turmoil, I argue, by the mid-1930s, that is the trials and all that, the political what you call it?
A struggle. Did you say struggle? You use a generic term,
That was the result of the encirclement of the threat from within in Russia.
Yep.
From within Russia, of they were sabotaging the factories.
Yep.
They were colluding with the Nazis.
Yep.
They were so, you know, people. I mean, I think it's legitimate to call it a second civil war. There was a civil war.
Yeah, it's difficult to say that it was a second civil war because it's kind of hard to figure out when the first one ended and the second one began, because there was a state of siege from the, you know, ab initio.
Yeah. So within this political fracture that was a kind of... It was real in Russia. It was undercover in the West, this civil war in Russia.
Right.
So what the propagandists in the West did was seize on the political facet of the development of the Soviet Union and created a mythology around that, ignoring the economic development under extreme stress.
Right.
So when the left outside Russia ignores the economic advances and social advances and focuses on the political repression that they call repression, they are not left. I think the line of the left is whether or not you support the development of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I mean, look. I think the thing that really conveys the essence of it is the actual, you know, point of contention or point of divergence between what was being followed in the USSR with Stalin and others, Bukharin, and that which was the criticism. The policy that was adopted was essentially an acknowledgement of the fact that the revolution in Germany didn't happen, that there was no revolution in the United States or in the UK or any place else. And so the idea of global revolution happening and Russia following was abandoned in favor of the reality that the working class and peasants held power in the Soviet Union and not anywhere else. So they would build socialism in one country. And that was the policy that was being followed. And that was criticized by Trotsky and others as being impossible and counter-revolutionary. In other words, the reality of it is they were saying, you can't do this, you have to have a bourgeois state and wait for the rest of the world to catch up.
And the argument also was, if we can, let socialism survive in the Soviet Union, it will help the rest of the world's communist parties, the rest of the world.
Right, but
it didn't mean that they were isolated.
Right.
Anyway.
Right.
But let's see how this drama between what I call an authentic left and a deluded, extravagant, romantic, obstructive left, all of those things apply, right. All of those adjectives.
Yep.
You know, what is this other left, the one that opposes the Soviet Union? Or what are their goals? What are their ideas? And this played out very well, not very well, actually, but this played out in Catalonia.
Mm.
So let's look at it. Now, we have two forces that opposed the Soviet Union in the Spanish Civil War, the anarchists and the Trotskyists, the PUM, which argues that it wasn't Trotskyist, but the ideas were there. So we have these two anti-Soviet, that called the Soviet Union counter-revolutionary, the anarchists and the Trotskyists. So the anarchists in Catalonia entered the governing institution of the state, contrary to their dogma, to defend Catalonia against the Falangists. They eventually joined the government.
Right.
And how did they help to govern? Well, by the evidence, by obstructing the class unity of the United Front. So both anarchists and Trotskyists opposed the United Front.
Right.
And why? Because it was issued by the Soviet Union, which they call counter-revolutionary. All right, so by obstructing the class unity of the United Front and basically defying the consensus of the Comintern, this is your left of 1935,
right,
requiring solidarity among the anti-fascist forces, including the middle classes. Yeah. You know, the anti-fascist middle
yep.
classes. So, right. What did they do? They proceeded, the anarchist in particular, their CNT trade union, they proceeded to institute a social revolution. So what were the measure and effect of this social revolution? These are the anti-Stalinists who propose something better than something more effective in their eyes of the United Front. Okay, so throughout Catalonia, many sectors of the economy fell under the control of the anarchist CNT, the trade union, and which united with the socialist UGT trade unions. And here, workers' self-management was implemented. And this is called by people like Noam Chomsky the revolution. This is called the revolution, and see what happens. Self-management included railways, streetcars, buses, taxi cabs, shipping, electric light and power companies, gas works and water works, engineering and automobile assembly plants, mines, mills, factories, food processing plants, theaters, newspaper, bars, hotels. Never mind.
Yeah.
Trade union control spread to small businesses of the middle classes.
Right.
Artisans, handicraftsmen, and tradesmen. This is your petty bourgeoisie.
Right, that's right. So libertarian socialism, essentially, what they were calling social revolution was establishing, in essence, a libertarian socialism, like a sort of a petty bourgeois anarchism.
And this is socialism imposed by above,
right, exactly.
By an organization called the CNT.
Right.
And they accused the Soviet Union, the Communist
right.
Party of the Soviet Union, of ruling from above.
Right, exactly.
And they're doing the same, you know, the of same course. Thing they accused the others of doing. Which,
right.
Okay, so in Barcelona, the CNT collectivized the sale of fish and eggs, slaughterhouses, milk processing. They socialized them. And they tried to persuade the members of the middle class and the small bourgeoisie to join the revolution. Think about, which we will talk next week, think about how the Soviets organized. They weren't organized top-down as it's maintained by the Bolsheviks. They arose on their own.
That's right.
And we'll talk about that. That's a myth. About the Soviets being, you know, the Soviets, the
right.
Workers' Council,
right.
being a kind of plot of the Bolshevik Party or an initiative.
No. First came the councils, then came the Soviet state.
Yes.
Okay.
It wouldn't have been possible, but
that's
look
it.
At the contradictions here. You know, they go and convince the middle classes, whereas it's the opposite. The Soviets
exactly.
put
yep.
pressure on the Bolshevik Party.
That's right.
To
That's
act.
Right.
But
right.
we'll talk about that next
yep.
time. And these classes were generally unwelcoming to being expropriated, essentially, of their businesses under force or threat of force. In other words, there was chaos. Chaos within chaos. And so how did this social revolution work out? Well, Orwell celebrated it in homage to Catalonia, but we have testimonials from a CNT member, which kind of is representative. Alberto Perez Barol describes the initial economic confusion. After the first few days of euphoria, the workers returned to work, he wrote, and found themselves without responsible management. This resulted in the creation of workers' committee in the factories, workshops, and warehouses, which tried to resume production with all the problems that the transformation of this kind entailed. And mind you, this was happening in the middle of a civil war.
Right.
This damn stupid revolution, which divided the United Front.
Right.
And divided the classes and antagonized them and put them one against the other. This does not seem sensible to me. Mm-hmm. So, owing to inadequate training and the sabotage of some of the technicians who remained, many others had fled with their owners, workers' committees were improvised and had to rely on guidance of the unions. This is top down again.
Yep.
So, and they, you know, lacking training in economic matters, the union leaders began to issue directives that spread confusion in the factory committee and enormous chaos in production in the middle of a civil war.
Which allowed not only its defeat by Franco, but Franco was the last of the fascist dictators to lose power some 25 years after World War II. And we're going to come back to this next week, because the way that they explain what happened to continue this trend is that it was the Communist Party of Spain and Stalin that essentially sabotaged it by discouraging the creative spirit that had, you know, been released by these events.
Yep.
And I guess they were really effective because they so discouraged it that Franco held power till the 1970s. It's such a ridiculous quote-unquote analysis that it doesn't really warrant much more than passing reference. But Luciana, thank you very much. We'll pick it up here next week. And again, I'm really enjoying this. I know our audience is, and most importantly, I think this is something that is extremely needed at the moment with what's happening in the world. So thank you.
Thank you, Don. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. Once deemed a noble way of stripping the corrupt of the protective cover of secrecy, leaking has by now evolved into a full-blown weapon of mass destruction, practiced as eagerly as it is denounced. At a time when digging and releasing sensitive information is the preferred political tactic, is there still room for genuine whistleblowing? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Rudolf Elmer, a former Swiss banker turned tax haven whistleblower. Mr. Elmer, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Now, back in the early 2000s, when you tried to share with the public some of the compromising material on the practices of your former employer, that was a fairly rare thing to do. But nowadays, everybody is leaking, usually for self-serving purposes, but also saying that it is for the good of the public. Why do you think this phenomenon of leaking has caught on to such an extent?
I do think there is a public interest in it in general, but there is also interest from a money point of view in respect of, let's say, increase the sale of newspapers. There is also a interest in respect of power. I mean, the powerful organizations and people like to manipulate the society with information. It has changed in that respect that now the man in the street can use information, make it public, for instance, as I did with WikiLeaks, and talk to the world. So there is a inflation of information, which definitely needs to be looked at it very carefully. What is true? What is fake? There is much manipulation going on, and people, that means me, have to be aware of it.
Okay, and Mr. Elmer, I'm sure you would agree with me that the accusations of attempted manipulation are flying both ways. And, you know, to illustrate that, I just want to mention that there was an article in the Atlantic magazine recently, which referred to WikiLeaks, the organization that you cooperated with, as a radical transparency organization. I found this phrasing very interesting. I know you had your differences with WikiLeaks, but just as a matter of principle, do you believe that there is such a thing as transparency radicalism, or perhaps even transparency extremism?
Yes, there is. I still believe that certain information shouldn't go public. We still have to respect privacy of people or the organization. It is really a matter of, is it in the public interest, that the public interest is more important than the interest of the company to keep the information away from the public. That's important to value that way of information, how it gets public and what sort of information gets public.
But speaking about WikiLeaks, do you think they could be indeed accused of being too radical in their quest for transparency?
Yes, I do think so. I mean, WikiLeaks, we have to look at it fundamentally. WikiLeaks is a, or used to be a platform to provide information anonymously, and it is made public. Now, WikiLeaks has changed the last few years, and I do understand from a Julian Assange point of view that he has a personal issue with the United States, but I do think he, because of his personal issues, he becomes a kind of bias. So therefore, the information which is published, for instance, in the Trump case, that he had contact with the junior Trump, confuses me totally, because it really has to be independent information, and information which is provided by sources, not kind of used for making public, using the tool WikiLeaks, which is an important tool, as a political instrument to influence elections wherever in the world.
Well, Mr. Elmer, it's not only Julian Assange who has issues with the United States. It's the United States which has issues with Julian Assange. So it's not only mutual. They, I think, rely on pretty similar tactics. Take, for example, the Atlantic piece that I already mentioned. It's full of contempt for WikiLeaks and its mode of operation. But on the other hand, the whole narrative is based on the leaked and, I suppose, initially confidential message exchange between WikiLeaks and Donald Trump Jr. Is that a fair game now, reserving the right of privacy and leaks for yourself but denying them to your opponent?
Yes, that's very confusing, and I don't think that's the way it should work at all, because it's basically abusing that platform, and it's, in my view, an issue about WikiLeaks itself that it should stop that sort of practice, at least to remain independent. Otherwise, it's just like a tabloid press.
You took an issue with the WikiLeaks efforts to reach out to Trump Jr., but I know you also had the difficulties with getting the media and the authorities interested in the kind of information you were hoping to provide. How else would you try to build those relationships? Because from what I know, from what was written, actually, WikiLeaks also tried to press the Trump camp with releasing its own sensitive data. So that supposedly would also be in the public interest.
Yeah, obviously it is in the public interest. But WikiLeaks, if WikiLeaks, and that's what it's known, that Julian Assange requested that tax forms are provided to WikiLeaks and they will publish the information. Already that step shows a kind of being biased, playing an active role, in my view. I believe And in my case, I actually tried to solve the issue with the authorities in Switzerland, with the Swiss tax authorities, with the courts. And when I learned that that doesn't work, that the legal system doesn't work, then I said, look, I have to take it to a higher level. And the higher level is definitely, that was in WikiLeaks. Now, this internal email contact, which was published by WikiLeaks on Hillary Clinton, that sort of thing, first of all, should have actually been handled internally first.
From what I know, it was handled internally. We now know from the revelations by Donna Brazil, the interim head of the DNC, that there was, in fact, a secret agreement between the Clinton camp and the party's leadership financial agreement long before she was pronounced the nominee. So she herself suggested that that was unethical. But do you really believe that in the current climate that exists in the United States, Hillary Clinton could get just as fair of a trial as, for example, Donald Trump?
As a matter of fact, I don't believe that sort of thing. It's how we call it, very politically driven. And to get a fair trial on that level, I think it's not possible. I even think that trial will never happen, because one or the other way, that trial will be stopped before it really starts.
Speaking about how you handle this information, because even after the Donna Brazil's revelations, there's virtually no discussion in the American media on the actual substance, on the content of that agreement or those leaked emails. And the argument from the Clinton side is that that information was inappropriately acquired, and therefore it should not be considered. What is your take on that? Do you think, when you deal with issues like that, do you think the information, the case in point, should be considered based on the content and possible public significance, or simply based on how the information was or wasn't obtained? Because we do not know full details as of now.
As we know today that our system doesn't really work at all, in the sense of now with banking information, for instance, with the Swiss bank secrecy, which wasn't possible to provide the to get the information on a legal way, because, for instance, Germany bought CDs and actually paid money for it, so that information was provided illegally. Today's system, as a matter of fact, and that's also on the political side, it's close to impossible to legally obtain that information, because you have to see, the laws are made by parliaments, by more or less by multinationals, more or less by high net worth individuals. And those laws actually protect themselves. It's not the protection of the man in the street. It's more a protection of themselves. So the information which is obtained illegally, that's the only way to get the information out to the public. Unfortunately, we have to change the laws. I mean, I do believe in democracy and in law, but as it is. Of today in many states, that's not possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Helmer, for the record, I also believe in democracy and the rule of law. And I think one upside in this whole leaking and counter-leaking saga would be that the only way to put an end to that is to conduct transparent, efficient, honest governance. Then you wouldn't have enough compromising material to leak. Do you think that is a possibility after all this debacle with emails and counter emails and so on and so forth?
It's very difficult that you get a honest government. There are always interests, which are national interests. However, there are ways to make that information available for society in a way that it's legal, and I would say in, we don't have any protection for whistleblowers at all. If you do have protection for whistleblowers on in the public sector as well as in the private sector, that information would have been or can be made public, and that actually puts pressure on the parliament to become more honest in and do their business in favor of the public. But as long as those whistleblowers are not protected, there is no real force there who requests for or forces the parliament to look at the issue seriously. I mean, if you consider we had LuxLeaks, we had the Panama Leaks, now we have the Paradise Leaks. Slowly but surely, the parliaments are going to be interested in this issue, but it simply takes time because that information becomes known to the parliament and they are forced to do so. But it's an easy way to do it. I mean, basically, if you have the protection of whistleblowers in both sectors, it will work.
But Mr. Elmer, as I'm sure you understand, that also affects certain very powerful interests, and perhaps that's where the reluctance to change anything comes from. Anyway, Mr. Elmer, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Rudolf Elmer, a former Swiss banker and a tax haven whistleblower. Mr. Elmer, your own case is obviously different because it involves not only your former employer, whom you are accused of tax manipulations, but also a huge institutional interest, that is Swiss banking secrecy, which ultimately allowed Switzerland to become a magnet, such a magnet for private foreign money. What is a bigger threat for you now that your case is under appeal? Is it the bank you used to work for or the country as such?
In my view, it's basically the country. But I'm more than happy that out of the cows are Elmer, I mean, the whistleblower Elmer, it has turned into a causa Swiss bank secrecy. And it's a causa which relates not only to Switzerland, it also relates to all secrecy jurisdictions with a secrecy law, so call them tax havens. How far does the secrecy law go? And in my case, they are now trying to apply the secrecy law extraterritorially. Basically, that means that I was employed in the Cayman Islands, and they are saying now, I'm under Swiss bank secrecy. If the federal court says that's correct, what the higher prosecution office argues, then it would mean that an employee, let's say in Mumbai, working for a Swiss bank because they outsourced business down there, is on the Swiss bank secrecy.
I just want to clarify it for our viewers that you were acquitted last year, but now the prosecutors are appealing your case, and they're in fact arguing that regardless of where a person, a supposed offender is, as long as he or she is working for Swiss banks, he or she should comply with the secrecy law, which means that potentially the Swiss law could be applied in any other country. I'm sure you disagree with that, and I'm sure many other countries would disagree with that, but what do you think are the chances of the Supreme Court agreeing with that?
I don't think they are that high at all, because it would actually create a tremendous international debate, and I do know that EU Parliament as well is looking already at the case. However, you never know, because we're talking here about a money-making industry, which is key for Switzerland. And therefore, even the federal courts will try to find me guilty one or the other way. I'm pretty sure about it.
Mm-hmm. But as you said, there is a huge institutional interest on one hand, the case of Switzerland and how it makes its money. But on the other hand, there are also huge institutional interest in the EU, the United States, in increasing transparency. Do you think that would be a consideration for the judges?
I do think they have to consider that thing. But as a judge, you can't make a decision due to political issues. As a judge, you're actually forced to use the law and to apply the law, which was agreed and set up by the parliament. They don't have any room to make any political decision. In theory, in practice, it looked different because I was found guilty violating Swiss bank secrecy twice at the lower court of Zurich, and at least 12 judges looked at the case and they said, I'm guilty. So therefore, they have made a political decision.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Elmer, I think we can still agree that the Swiss secrecy law has been under pressure from a number of Western players, most notably the United States, also the European Union. There has been some action against the Swiss banks. And I heard experts say before that as the Swiss bankers' ability to paddle secrecy decreases, they may come up with alternative business strategies. So, for example, they may cater more to the clients from politically unstable developing countries and to try to sell stability rather than secrecy. Has that come to pass? Do you see any change in how Swiss banks market their services?
Yes, I'm pretty sure there are many of them already. I mean, they have had a lot of time to adapt to the pressure which is made by the international society. For instance, ultra-high net worth individuals or for multinationals, you still can set up structures where you don't have a human being behind it. I mean, in the early days, the ultra-high net worth individuals were just not willing to expend so much money for the administration side to set up a proper structure, but that structure is still possible today. Secondly, Switzerland has a so-called SWIFT center in the state of Zurich set up in 2011. So the payments are made within Switzerland, and as Swiss bank secrecy still exists, that sort of payments are under Swiss bank secrecy. So that's another one. A third one is that we do have the army bunkers. The army bunkers are now rented out to ultra-high net worth individuals to, for instance, to put gold or any valuables in there, which basically means that is another business model which undermines even the money laundering laws. The outsourced sort of business to, let's call it, other tax havens, new tax havens, because you have to understand the tax haven business is so money-making that every country is really interested in being a tax haven.
So it's a very profitable business from what you say. But correct me if I'm wrong, I think there has also been some efforts, or at least appearance of efforts, on the part of the Swiss authorities to investigate where the money are coming from. There have been a number of high-profile investigations, usually involving politically disagreeable countries, including Russia. I'm sure you know about the probe into Russia's former agricultural minister, Yelena Skrinnik, and her $70 million assets in Swiss banks. Do you take that as a genuine pursuit of possible economic crisis, or is that just political or geopolitical singling out?
My view is on what's really going on in Switzerland. There are investigations performed. However, those investigations are done due to political reasons, and I'm pretty sure many of those investigations will be closed without any result. If you talk about FIFA, if you talk about Russia, I'm pretty sure I know we have a lot of Russian money in Switzerland. They will find reasons to close that case. I mean, we had this issue with automatic information exchange, and Russia was so-called considered by the right-wing politics a corrupt country. I don't want to value on that one at the moment, but they said it's a corrupt country. We do not exchange information automatically with a corrupt country. And as a matter of fact, I mean, they have signed the contract with Russia, Switzerland, and they will revalue shortly before automatic information exchange will set into force if Russia is still a corrupt country. It's not being solved at all.
Mr. Elmer, you raised the issue of corruption, and it is a major problem for this country. Former or perhaps even current officials or well-connected businessmen siphoning off money from this country, not only for tax evasion purposes. Sometimes it's simply pure stealing of money from the budget or from banking accounts of private citizens. It's certainly an issue of internal oversight, and this is something that the Russian government has to address. But to what extent do you think this problem is abated by the permissive practices of Western financial institutions?
Western financial institutions or even tax havens all over the world, they will support that sort of thing because they're going to make money about it. But there are a lot of reasons to explain why things are clean. I mean, for instance, the bank I worked for, we had so-called politically exposed people. We reviewed those clients every 3 months, but there was a list which was called permanent exceptions. These were clients which not only were politically exposed people, they also had a criminal record. And basically what the banking world does, if something gets public, then they will tell the client, leave the bank, we kick you out, because the information system the financial institutions have with related to criminal cases, they know very well ahead before an investigation is started what's going on, and then they get rid of their clients.
Well, Mr. Elmer, what you're saying is very depressing, but I wonder if there is a slight hope of the times changing, perhaps. We live in an era when increased transparency is not just a moral aspiration, it's a practical consequence of technological advance. Do you think the Swiss status as one of the world's biggest tax havens will survive the technologies such as blockchain and the like?
Yes, I do think so. But you have to see, key issues are not the instruments as such. In my view, key issues are that if someone gets caught, that the person is made personally responsible, that the person goes to prison, which makes them really afraid of going using criminal actions. Or, for instance, with the big fours, because the big fours are actually the enablers tax evasion, because they work globally. They have 180 countries offices, and they do the audit, they do as well the tax advice to the multinationals, but they are not responsible for what they say. So in my view, because for instance, those big fours do have a task to serve the public as well, they have to confirm that in the audit report on a yearly level that there is no material, and we're talking about materiality, they know what that means, that there's no material profit shifting from one to the other country. You have to make those people responsible for it, and that they are getting afraid of, I have to go to prison or the country might be punished with sanctions or from the international community. That sort of thing is key. I mean, you can set up structures, but if there is no point where someone gets really responsible for it, then and say, look, the fines we pay is simply business costs. Or, for instance, we had a case in Switzerland where a banker was convicted of helping in tax evasion. He had to pay 1,000 Swisses, and that was it, basically. That sort of thing has to change.
I see. Well, Mr. Elmer, this is all we have time for. Thank you very much for being with us today. And to our viewers, please share your comments on our Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube pages. And I hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.